Today at Reader's Corner, Ilya Ponomarenko, author of the new book, I Will Show You How It Was, The Story of Wartime Kyiv. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In late February 2022, a series of missiles and rocket strikes began falling on Ukraine as the Russian military barreled over the border and fanned out across the country. They quickly took Chernobyl, Kherson, and Mariupol. But in Kyiv, Ukraine's capital, the Russians sustained heavy losses, and their blitz failed as they faced overwhelming resistance. The interview today is unusual because, first of all, it's an interview with a Ukrainian reporter on the ground in the middle of war. Consequently, his answers are longer than we are normally used to hear at Reader's Corner. But I felt, given his wartime background and this heart-wrenching memoir, it was important to let Ilya Ponomarenko speak at length. The book he has written is called I Will Show You How It Was, The Story of Wartime Kyiv. In the interview you're about to hear, he will refer to yesterday in reference to the recent bombing of the Children's Hospital in Kyiv, which is how I lead off this interview, because I saw no way to address this book without first addressing the latest casualties and violence in Ukraine. Ilya Ponomarenko, thank you for joining us at Reader's Corner all the way from Bucha, Ukraine.
Hello, thank you very much for having me. I'm really glad I'm here.
I read your book and was so impressed, but somewhat distracted from it after I read it, when just recently a children's hospital was bombed. I just feel it's so important that perhaps we begin there and you address your reaction to that. You're in Bucha, which could be called maybe a suburb of Kyiv. It's in the Oblast area, and you can explain that. But we are just so concerned over here about what is happening on a day-to-day basis in Ukraine. I wonder if you have any comments about this hypersonic missile that takes us into a whole different ballgame, so to speak.
Well, of course, what happened yesterday was a terrible tragedy. And that was something that literally all of Kyiv and the entire Kyiv metropolitan area had literally was listening to and hearing these explosions. Even in my place, Bucha could be very correctly called a northwestern suburb of Kyiv, a quiet small town, very beautiful, pretty rich. But nonetheless, even in this quiet place, which has seen more than enough suffering and misery, we heard the explosions, we heard the blasts. Pretty much all across Ukraine, we have something that we call mobile air defense groups, which is actually military guys with air defense guns trying to shoot down drones or missiles. And this is what we heard in our place too. So yesterday morning, that happened before noon, was a terrible tragedy that comes from an extremely evil man who is so zealous, who is so eager to hold on to his power, who's so absolutely obsessed with this goal of having a revenge on Ukraine and exterminating Ukraine as the sign of his lifetime humiliation and the barrier to his absolute power. And what happened was a war crime, but I interpret this as deliberate strike on the Children's Hospital, which is very famous and very large, I must say, in Kyiv and in Ukraine. I interpret it as a sort of a new phase in which Russia is trying to enforce Ukrainian surrender, not through only attacks on infrastructure, power grids, heating, things of that kind, but also with direct and overt murder of civilians, particularly the most vulnerable people, like sick children. That was a cancer hospital. So I'm seriously afraid of the fact that they're switching to much more brutal overt killings of civilians in order to enforce a Ukrainian surrender. That's what I get from this.
Well, I thought that's where we were going when I brought up the subject of this horrible attack on the Children's Hospital yesterday. It does seem, as you say, to take the war to a new and even more dangerous level. These supersonic or hypersonic missiles that Russia used to travel at over 6,000 miles an hour. And if our listeners are trying to figure out what that means from America, the Minuteman III is being tested in Florida right now, and it takes 30 minutes to get that missile to Moscow. So it gives you some idea of how little opportunity there is to react. And I guess that's the point. But let's pick up the conversation, Ilya, from your standpoint, hearing as you did recently that United States support had finally cleared Congress and additional arms were on their way. What does that do as a game changer? And then we'll jump right back into the Battle of Kiev in 2022.
When it comes to the supply of weapons, the U.S. supply is absolutely essential. It's vital. Do not quote me on this. It's sort of my estimate that the United States is alone responsible for close to 65-75% of Ukraine's defense efforts in this war. And it touches specific and crucial fields such as air defense, armored vehicles, maintenance, so many things that are so essential for Ukraine to have in full supply and to use all the time in battlefields and also in the defense of its home front too. So when it comes to what happened yesterday and the terrible tragedy that happened yesterday, it's in many ways also an outcome of many months of United States assistance not coming to Ukraine, because it touches upon air defense and air defense munitions and interceptors for Patriot systems as well. So in many ways, what Russia is doing, not only in terms of Ukrainian air defense, but also on battlefields too, they are using this winds of opportunity that was created by this gap in essential U.S. supplies to Ukraine. Unfortunately, what we have seen yesterday is the most brutal and the most bloodletting act of Russian missile bombing campaign on the recent months. They've been using this opportunity to knock out a lot of our energy grid, which is why in many ways we have, for instance, terrible internet connection problems. We spend most of our days without any electricity, and we have to adapt to a new life to that. But I believe that they are really switching to much more overt killing of civilians in terror bombings. In many ways, because even despite all these months in extremely dire shortage of everything and anything in Ukrainian military, especially when it comes to air defense, even with lots of problems with other regards when it comes to internal problems of Ukrainian military and also the support of our friends and bakers in the West, even with this, Russian advances are way too slow, still way too slow. They're spending over the resources on these minimal advances in Ukrainian battlefields is way too high, unacceptably high, even to Russia. So I believe, and I'm afraid, really afraid of this fact, is that they truly understand that they find it extremely and increasingly hard to defeat Ukraine in a conventional war on battlefields, provided that the West stays with Ukraine and the aid keeps flowing in. So they switch to pure civilian terror in terms of the most vulnerable people that we have, particularly kids, hospitals. I don't know what else could be hit next in attempt to enforce a surrender upon the Ukrainian society. So I think that's what's happening in many regards. But I don't believe that they will be successful in this. They never work. Such things never work in history.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Ilya Ponomarenko, author of the book, I Will Show You How It Was, The Story of Wartime Kyiv. Well, when you talk about trying to convince the Ukrainian people that it's time for some kind of negotiation, you do mention in your book negotiations for peace. And it's rather tough talk because, in a sense, as I remember it, you're somewhat critical of those who would try to give away Ukraine before the Ukrainian people have had a chance to defend it, so to speak.
The problem is that when it comes to negotiations with Russia, the problem is they are not looking for peace.
Yeah.
They are not looking for a just ending of this war. When they talk about negotiations and peace, they mean only one thing: the Ukrainian surrender, unconditional surrender, and Ukraine accepting all the terms that are incompatible with Ukraine existing as an independent nation, as an identity, and as a real country on its own. The problem is that they are propagating these peace negotiations, so-called peace negotiations, for the sake of getting a short respite in the war that they dearly need. And not many people actually talk about this in media. They need a respite, they will get it, and they will use this time to get back in better shape. So what was supposed to be sort of a peace and finally the end of the war and, you know, everybody getting rid of this headache, including in the West, will eventually get back as even worse war, as something even more disastrous, with Russia fixing mistakes and coming back in much better shape. The thing is that Russians are really, and their propaganda machine, they are really smart about this, and they are really exploiting this tempting idea of, you know, making Ukraine do certain concessions. They propagating this easiest way of going through this war. They are propagating an easy choice for the Western leaders and for Western audiences, such as, again, make Ukraine surrender, make Ukraine cede some territories and accept, you know, the ban on membership of NATO and so on and so forth. But the problem is, it's not about, you know, certain regions, not about certain city that Putin would get and thus calm down and leave Ukraine forever alone. The problem is, it's about the entire Ukraine. There is nothing that you can give to you, Putin. There is no promise that you can guarantee him, such as, you know, no Ukraine in NATO. There won't be a moment when he says, okay, now I'm happy, I'm leaving Ukraine alone forever. It's about the entire Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So there need to be no illusions. We are highly critical of this potential negotiations or concessions and talks. Not because we're stubborn, not because we love this war, we don't. Nobody wants peace more than us Ukrainians. But the problem is that the false prophets of peace are not promising peace. They're not here for peace. They are here for a short respite. They are here for tempting the West into abandoning Ukraine in this way, because without this, they will not able to win and get what they want.
Mm-hmm.
So the only chance is to make Ukraine surrender and, moreover, make the West surrender and give up on Ukraine. That's the only way. That's why we propagate against this tempting deal with the devil that will inevitably end up being a disaster, even worse disaster than what we have right now.
And if by some chance there ever was some kind of a surrender or the West conceded, then the next question for Russia is, they're going to have to live with whatever has been created. And what your book proves to me is that the indomitable spirit of the Ukrainian people will not quit just because the West might concede. And I want to move to your book now because I think it shows, it predicts in a way, that the next phase of this war could well be guerrilla warfare in the cities,
yeah,
where Ukrainians are still standing up. They haven't given up just because Russia and somebody else has decided to create a negotiated pact. They're in this for keeps to guarantee their freedoms. So take us to the volunteer battalions called the Territorial Defense Battalion, which was created during the Kiev War, and what that does tell us about the spirit of the Ukrainian people.
I will simply give you several pieces of memories or examples,
yeah,
that will explain to you everything that you have to, you need to know about, you know, Ukraine of the modern time. You know, we were mentioning this terrible tragedy with the Russian bombing of children's hospital, and you could see pictures of very regular people from the street Kievans coming to the ground zero and actually helping the rescuers, you know, bringing food and water and clearing up, you know, all debris. Very regular people. And these pictures from yesterday, they really brought my memories back to the days of the Battle of Kyiv in February, March 2022, when there was so much enthusiasm, you know, this outbreak of defiance towards evil, this very powerful and very pure outburst of what of the best things about the human nature, this bravery, this unity, this absolute desire to do what is right and to believe what is right, no matter the odds. So I remember, you know, these pictures of enthusiasm in the face of the mortal danger and in the face of the doomsday. It's really very common for Ukrainians. They really do it in moments like this, in the darkest times. So that's why during the Battle of Kyiv, I will never forget this moment when we saw regular people in the streets of Kyiv in the first days of February getting their rifles from the police, just in the streets of Kyiv, very regular people just like you and me. They were getting large boxes of Kalashnikov rifles and ammo to fight Russians, because we were expecting Russians to enter the northern parts of Kyiv. And in those districts, people were getting ready to fight and preparing, you know, Molotov cocktails too. Those were regular people in the streets. They had all chances to flee, you know, do whatever it takes or to surrender, but nonetheless, and noted that many of those people were holding their rifles for the first time ever in their lives. They were ready to fight and die for their own streets. Very regular people. Because this is what you do in moments like this. This is what Ukrainians do in moments like this. Because people sometimes imagine this as sort of a, you know, Ukraine can surrender, Ukraine can accept even the most direst Russian conditions, Russian occupation. But at the same time, you know, it's not the end of the world. You know, life goes on and stuff like that. But the problem is that it's not going to work. It doesn't work that way. Over the last decade of this war with Russia that's happened since 2014, and then with the full-scale invasion, over this decade, Ukraine has changed so much on so many levels, culturally, linguistically, mentally. Ukrainian nation has changed very much in terms of understanding itself, understanding its pride, its dignity, its position in this state. Its role as a driver of democracy, as the master of this country, as opposed to Russia and its authoritarian rule. Ukrainians are so different from Russians and from the understanding of Russia as a state and the way Russia rules its people. So that we are absolutely incompatible, especially when it comes to the youth, especially when it comes to active, you know, part of the society. So you were very correct to mention territorial defense units that were created all across Ukraine and Kyiv too. And they were joined by very, very regular people, such as radio hosts, lots of my friends, journalists, taxi drivers, people from all corners of life, celebrities too, hip-hop stars, rock stars, singers, actors, many of them. Because, you know, the entire idea of Ukrainians being different from Russia, having a country on its own, having its own life, its own way of life, its own understanding of itself as a nation. It is so absolutely necessary. It's so basic in the Ukrainian society right now. And after that, lots of blood spilled by Russia, lots of grief caused by Russia. And in the end, you get a country that is absolutely hostile to any sort of idea of getting back to Russian, to be in the Russian colony again. We are so incompatible to so many levels, especially against the backdrop of the Russian full-scale invasion and everything that happens over the last two and a half years. Mm-hmm. It's simply incompatible, because you were also very correct to mention the possibility of guerrilla war. And people in the West, many observers, they are deeply mistaken, thinking that if movers and shakers enforce some sort of a surrender upon Ukraine, theoretically speaking, the war will end. The war will not end. It will switch to armed resistance,
right?
guerrilla style. That's 100%. So, and admittedly, you know, my book was supposed, in the beginning, the working title of my book was supposed to be Guerrilla Radio. Because in the final days of the invasion, I was almost certain, and many of us here in Ukraine, journalists, I mean, in the community, we were almost certain about the war switching to guerrilla war, unwinnable war for Russia in our case. So we were almost sure to expect a large and winnable guerrilla war, popular resistance here in Ukraine. Things went in a pretty different way, but at the same time, I give you 100% guarantee that Ukrainian people simply would not accept Russia, especially when it comes to what Russia is today, especially when it comes to everything that happened to so many places like Bucha, for instance, you know, mass graves, terrible things. And we must understand that we have no illusions when it comes to what's going to happen when Russians get back after all the blood that they have spilled in Ukraine, after all the anger, all the hatred that was nurtured against Ukrainians amid this war. So there need to be no illusions about, you know, the life in the enslaved Ukraine. That's going to be a nightmare.
We are still reading new books published as late as last week, perhaps, about the heroic exploits of World War II veterans. And no doubt the war in Ukraine will continue to produce similar heroics as you describe in your book. And that book is I Will Show You How It Was, The Story of Wartime Kiev. Could you talk about the Ukrainian Air Force pilots? You call it our finest hour, which I assume is a tagline taken from Mr. Churchill. But please explain.
Yeah, of course. Old Grandpa Winston was with us in the final hours before the invasion, in the most terrible months and days of the full-scale invasion. Because, you know, in Ukraine, just like everywhere in the world, you know, the image, the, you know, romanticized in many ways image of Winston Churchill is extremely popular too. You know, it's very telling. It's something that, you know, human beings naturally strive to. They're looking for symbols. And we, back then, and even now, we needed symbols, we needed figures imagined to be strong decision makers, historical figures that are capable of historical decisions and who are capable of leading and taking responsibility and winning and, you know, leading people into battles. So, yeah, I remember even the moment when, I think that was the night before the invasion, like last hours of peace, and I'm having a book that pictures a really young Winston Churchill on its cover, and I was thinking that, yeah, you'll be with us. You'll be the symbol of this very inspiring, dramatic, and tragic battle that's coming our way. So through that, you know, when it comes to the Ukrainian military, of course, you know, we have like sort of a consensus in, you know, general populations, way of thinking that, you know, the Ukrainian armed forces and in general, the Ukrainian defense forces, they demonstrated something that is historically incredible as an organization, even though it has a lot of flaws. But, you know, especially when it comes to the earliest weeks of the war, there was so much enthusiasm, but so much of the military sacrifice, you know, with the mechanized units, with tank units, especially when it comes to the Battle of Kiev and many other places, with the regular military units of Ukraine being so overwhelmed by Russians when it comes to, you know, their numerical superiority, them being so outnumbered and outgunned, yet they were fighting bravely. They were inventing new ways of overperforming, new ways of cheating. They were using every single possibility to fight and defeat and kill and destroy. So, you know, it's really hard to imagine so many people that are so loyal to their duty, as, you know, to people in the uniform, and people in the uniform who were facing this one of the biggest and the most relentless war machines in human history that was approaching our cities. Yet mechanized units, pilots, they were doing something incredible because they were believing what was right. They stayed loyal, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands of men and women, they were staying loyal, staying. There was no massive deserting in ranks. There were lots of occasions in which the military, of course, were all quickly overwhelmed by advancing Russian units, and they preferred to give up and surrender into captivity, of course. But in general, you know, the Ukrainian military managed to survive the first strike, managed to stay operational, and they demonstrated like 500% of what a human being in that condition, in that situation, could be capable of. You know, there was a good example with Air Force pilots, because Air Force used to be one of the weakest branches of Ukrainian uniformed forces, because we are talking about people who were flying increasingly obsolete aircraft. We talk about people who spend their lives serving for decades in a military force that is extremely obsolete, that is neglected, terribly underfunded. We're talking about young people, young pilots who graduated military academies to become pilots, but they very quickly became distracted from, you know, actual military force because of money issues, because of terrible organization. Yet when the moment comes, many of my friends that I know, I mean, I'm on young pilots, even though they were dismissed from service, they were actual civilians, yet they got back to their old military units and they had flight missions against Russians, who are technically, numerically, and in so many regards were absolutely overwhelmingly stronger than them. We talk about old, experienced pilots who essentially sacrificed themselves in dogfights against much more advanced Russian aircraft. In many cases, that was happening because they had to distract Russians from younger pilots so that younger pilots could leave airfields and regroup in other places. And we have many examples of heroic stories of old officers who sacrificed themselves for the sake of saving young pilots. And you know, in general, the story of the Ukrainian battle and the Battle of Kyiv especially is an example of what is best about the human nature. And and in general, it's a story in so many examples of the people who do incredible things in the wake of the apocalypse, and moreover, by believing in what is right, by doing what they had to do, by staying loyal to the best things that is out there about the human nature, about, you know, everyone's life, and by staying loyal to all those things, they win, because you know the outcome of the Battle of Kyiv.
And of course, the outcome of the Battle of Kyiv is that the Ukrainians held off the Russians, and you have just documented so very well how that managed to happen. I think you did refer in your book to a clever deception that the Ukrainian military employed at the outset of the Russian invasion. Just another example of how creative the Ukrainians were in dealing with a force so much stronger and larger than it.
Yes, that was happening, particularly with the Air Force, that in the final, literally hours, in the final hours before the invasion, when we definitely knew that's going to happen, the Air Force had a sort of a maneuver in which they took all the aircraft up in the sky so that they wouldn't be destroyed on the ground by Russians in their missile attacks, because we expect that. Same goes about, you know, the relocation of ground forces too. It didn't work in all ways. We had quite a lot of tragedies with Russian missiles attacking and destroying and killing a lot of personnel. But still, there's always a way. One of the biggest messages that I sent with my book, by describing all those things, by describing the atmosphere of the early weeks of the war, was that there is always a way out. There is always a way to go on, to win, to go on resisting without giving up. You know, there is always a way to go. So in many ways, you know, so many inventive decisions taken from the Ukrainian willingness to fight, to hold on to its independence, to keep their country in hands, so many decisions and so many moral choices too, positive moral choices towards, you know, fighting no matter the odds. And you remember the atmosphere back then when, you know, essentially half of the world was burning Ukraine alive and competing when it comes to the chances of Ukraine surviving 48 or 72 hours. And despite that, so many people simply did not agree with the fact that Ukraine was doomed. And they were doing all those little things and big things to overwhelm, to prevail over the evil, because we were enthusiastic. We were having a sort of a something that I call the enthusiasm of the doomed, like the final stand in many ways. Yeah. Same goes about, you know, the very reason why Russians were defeated and had to withdraw from Kyiv by late March 2022. They were over-reliant. They were deeply mistaken when it comes to the possibility of the Ukrainian resistance. They had little to no faith when it comes to Ukrainians willing to fight for their own country. And they had little faith in terms of Ukraine being able to use the advantages that are given to it as the country, as the, you know, the military power in its own country. So thus, you know, we had, you know, the famous long convoys of Russians stretching to tens of kilometers through our forest from Chernobyl area, for instance, to outskirts of Kyiv. And here we go with the Ukrainian mobile forces ambushing these convoys and leaving them with no fuel at all, and killing the personnel, and essentially making tanks stop, and making the giant forces bogged down in the outskirts of Kyiv. That's why you hear a lot about Bucha, Irpin, Hostomel, because those are outskirts of Kyiv and densely populated settlements. And they were making Russians bogged down in this brutal fighting in these settlements. Like I said, there is always a way out. And in many ways, I'm really glad that my book comes in such time, because in many ways, the Battle of Kyiv was and is a reminder to myself too, that no matter what happens, no matter how dark it is, there's always a way out. Always something that you can do if you are motivated to go on. And by staying on the good side, by believing what is right, by actually doing and by being ready to do what it takes, and by not giving up, there goes the way to victory. Mm-hmm. Even very uneven and unexpected success, because, you know, we all remember what were his expectations back then. Mm-hmm. Apparently, this is the way life works. Believe in what is right, do what is right, and there'll be a success. Mm-hmm. The life prevails.
I have time for one more question, Ilya. Sure. And it's about your personal safety. You opened up your book by sharing with your readers the fact that way back in 2014, when the Russians moved into Crimea, you were with the 72nd Mechanized Infantry Brigade, and you call it in your book the most dangerous 2 hours of your life. I don't think we need to get into that, but how do you feel about this today? How dangerous is your journalistic existence today in 2024?
Yeah, it's true that I've been doing this for nearly a decade, which is incredible, because sometimes I think about this, that, you know, for instance, I'm 32 years old, which means that I have spent one third part of my life amid this war, along with so many young people of my generation, you know, one third of your entire life amid this. And to us, and to myself in particular, this has been a lifetime project to report on the war, to participate in you know, reforms, in making this country a better place and stronger, and a stronger nation. So to me, it feels like not simply a job, but a commitment, a duty. A journalist in Ukraine is not working a job. He or she is serving a duty, especially when it comes to wartime. And it's a very common thing for many active citizens here in Ukraine, because, like I said, it's a lifetime project for so many in this country who are right now part of the military, who are working and providing volunteer aid, for instance, for the military, who pay taxes, who collect money and help disabled veterans who run charities too. So it's a national project for so many people. You perceive this as a natural state of things. So when I worked as a journalist for pretty much a decade, I deliberately worked as a like war zone guy, also defense and security guy, who you would deploy with the military forces in Ukraine's east when the war was localized to Ukraine's east, such as the famous and the glorious 72nd Mechanized, which was one of the key forces in the Battle of Kiev. So I find it very interesting that I spent most of my time with that brigade. Also, have seen a lot of combat clashes with that brigade as a reporter, of course. And I continued my life in the Battle of Kiev in the new phase of the war with the same brigade that was defending Kiev successfully and heroically defending Kiev. So I have seen quite a few extreme moments of this work, but I always believed that what we do was right, what we do was useful, especially when it comes to working in English language media outlets such as Kiev Post, Kiev Independent, that were telling the story of Ukraine to other nations and the the public opinion of other nations. When it comes to moments right now, because of certain problems with my health, I kind of got out of working as a frontline journalist, so I do not particularly go deployed to war zones anymore. Partly because it's a big problematic thing right now because of a lot of bureaucracy, a lot of problems on the front line, and because of the fact that I do not currently work at some official media outlet, which is a bit of a problem for your accreditation to work at the front line. So I mostly do things that I can do from home, for instance, or from home front, but I'm looking for opportunities to either get back to working as a journalist, as a war guy, or to join a military charity. I was rejected from mobilization, from conscription, several months ago because of health concerns. So I cannot be mobilized, but it doesn't mean that I do not have any service to serve for my country, for my people. So I live my life in the town of Bucha, and I enjoy living here. And I must say that we Ukrainians in the rear front in this cities, we live a life that is as close to normal as it can possibly be given the circumstances. And we enjoy the greatest gift given to us by the Ukrainian military, who win every day of freedom for us here, every single day. They spill blood, they do impossible things for us to go on enjoying more or less normal life, I would say. And for us to have another chance to support them and to adapt to life in wartime. So life is as normal as it can be here in Ukraine, in most of the cities. And that's the greatest gift to the Ukrainian, from the Ukrainian military to the entire nation. So one of the reasons why I wrote my book is that I wanted people our friends beyond Ukraine, I wanted them to understand what was at stake, what was the potential price, and what kind of absolute human heroism and what kind of incredible things happened in the Battle of Kiev that Ukraine won what it has right now, more than 2 years after, still existing, still fighting, still having hope, changing a lot of things in the world, in Western politics too, and still having hope of having a better tomorrow after war, without war.
Well, you have certainly succeeded at that, Ilya. You've written you've written a fine presentation of what you've been through these last few years. You call yourself a war guy. I want to reassure our listeners that is exactly what this book is. It is a book written by a war guy, a guy who experienced wartime Kiev and still to this very day experiences it in Ukraine. The name of the book is I Will Show You How It Was, The Story of Wartime Kiev. The author who we've been talking to is Ilya Ponomarenko. Ilya, we wish you the very best, and thank you for writing the book, and glory to Ukraine.
Thank you, and glory to heroes.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Custer. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
At Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.